In the summer of 1206, a strange phenomenon happened. Thousands of people from across the plains of Inner Asia began to gather beside a river in Mongolia. They had gathered there for a unique event in their history, and that was that one of their leaders, a relatively young man who had just turned 45 years old, but who had spent his lifetime fighting one tribe after another, Genghis Khan had finally united all the tribes.
Radio Netherlands Worldwide presents Cavalry, Caravans, and Christians. Genghis Khan and Europe's First Global Age. Presented by Marijke van der Meer.
And the people raised him up on a large white felt blanket. And then these hundreds of thousands of people held their hands out with the palms up towards the sky, and they slowly circled them clockwise, and they repeated the formula that Mongolians have repeated for thousands of years. Hooray, hooray, hooray. And with that proclamation, the Mongolian nation was formed.
Long live the koningin!
Every year, when the Queen of the Netherlands opens Parliament, she is acclaimed with a triple hurrah, a custom that has come down to us from the Mongols.
Yes, it was picked up by the Russians from the Mongols, and the Kazakhs began to use it, and then the Prussians picked it up from the Cossacks, and then from the Prussians it spread out into the rest of Europe.
This uncanny overlap of ancient custom and modern ritual is just a faint echo down the centuries of the tremendous impact which the Mongol invasions had on Europe. Dr. Jack Weatherford is professor of anthropology at McAllister College in Minnesota and the author of an acclaimed book, Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World.
Well, so far as we know, no person from Europe had ever been to China before Genghis Khan, and no person from China, so far as we know, had been to Europe. Yet, once the Mongols invaded Europe for the first time, they created a permanent contact that has not been broken till this day.
Within a generation of uniting the nomad tribes of the Eurasian steppes into one unified Mongol nation, Genghis Khan and his sons gained control of the largest contiguous land empire in history. At his death in 1227, Genghis Khan and his nomads had expanded his empire to an area twice the size of the United States today.
An economy that is based on extensive pastoral animal husbandry needs space. It needs space. No pasture can be grazed continuously. And no animal eats the same kind of grass. Camels eat different grass from sheep, from goats, from horses, from cattle. So therefore, to begin with, to even subsist, you need a vast area that you control.
Dr. Veronika Veit is professor of Mongol studies at Bonn University in Germany.
Certainly, Genghis Khan was a warrior of his time, that goes without saying. He had his own cruelties. He killed personally. He also killed spontaneously when he was jealous or in a rage or he thought somebody had deceived him. But all sources, enemy sources, friendly sources, agree on the point that he was very generous personally. He was very modest as far as his own person was concerned. Certainly he was the great Khan, but he was very fair-minded. Otherwise, how could he have retained the loyalty of such different people who followed him? In short, he was certainly a charismatic personality.
Eventually, Mongol power extended from the Pacific to the Mediterranean over an area the size of the African continent. The Mongols conquered China, most of present-day Russia, Central Asia, Persia, Anatolia, and the Caucasus. Mongol armies advanced to the fortified gates of towns in Hungary, Ukraine, and Poland. In Krakow, Poland, a trumpeter sounds the call to arms from the tower of St. Mary's Church on Market Square. He does this every single hour. The music stops abruptly just before the last note, just as it did in 1241, when the trumpeter's throat was pierced by a Mongol arrow. This hourly reminder of a siege that took place almost 800 years ago reflects the trauma and the suddenness of the Mongol advance. Europeans were overwhelmed by the speed of the invasion and could not defend themselves against the unconventional military tactics the Mongols used.
It might interest the listeners how many Mongol troops actually undertook this enormous campaign. Roughly 150,000. They had no infantry. Every Mongol cavalry soldier had three spare mounts, which enabled him to continuously ride without tiring out his horse. Apart from that, the Mongol army was completely self-reliant, self-sufficient. All their supplies they took with them. They had flocks of sheep and everything necessary with them.
The Mongols moved in the winter. They found the frozen rivers to be avenues or real highways for them. And this was a great surprise for the Europeans, who were much more accustomed to fighting in better weather. So the Mongols arrived at an unusual time. They were attacking at an unusual time. And almost everything about their way of war was different. So the Europeans were suddenly confronted with an armed cavalry. And the Europeans at this time tended to have armed people shooting bows and arrows, who would be separate from the infantry, who would be fighting with hand tools, which would be separate from the cavalry, who would be mounted and more aristocratic. The Mongols combined all three. And when they attacked, the Europeans didn't know how to defend themselves. They sort of waited for the Mongol attack to happen. But in fact, what happened was the Mongols would race towards the Europeans, firing their arrows as fast as they could, but they wouldn't actually stop and fight. They would then turn, and another wave of Mongol riders would come in, firing their bows. So it was completely based upon artillery. The Europeans had no defense against this, and the Europeans were decimated.
The Mongols were so merciless in their war, because if you left an enemy behind, he would rise again and might attack you unexpectedly. But if you defeated him, or if you won his loyalty, then, of course, that was absolutely no problem.
The Mongols certainly were ferocious in battle. There is absolutely no question. And people who resisted them suffered mightily. And one of the worst things that the Mongols did in the view of civilized people is that after conquest, the Mongols basically had no use for the aristocracy, for the rich people, and they killed them off. And this was just a horrible act in the eyes of most civilized people.
Foreigners called Tatars came in countless numbers like locusts into the land of Ryazan. The pagan and godless Tatars, having taken Ryazan, went to Volodymyr, a host of shedders of Christian blood. And the lawless Ismailites approached the town and surrounded the town in force. The pagans took the town and slew all from the male sex, even to the female, all the priests and the monks, and all stripped and reviled, gave up their souls to the Lord in a bitter and a wretched death.
Numerous contemporary descriptions, like this one from the Novgorod Chronicle in 1238, portray the Mongols as beastly cannibals. Some eyewitnesses believed they had come from hell. In Hungary, a third of the people were killed or imprisoned. However, it has to be said that most historical accounts about the Mongols have been written by their victims. For a different perspective, Professor Bolt Batar of the Mongolian Academy of Sciences and director of the Institute of Historical Research at the National University of Mongolia.
Marxist Historians from mostly Central Asian regions, or historians who formerly practiced Marxist notion of historiography, are the people who mostly write about Genghis Khan in the light of his brutality and conquests. They point at alleged millions and millions of people who were slaughtered during Genghis Khan's military campaigns. This is rather based on offensive and victimhood mentality of the people who are descendants of the victims of his conquest. For instance, certain scholars pointed at the fact that during the conquest of the city of Jand, over 1 million people were butchered by Mongol army. However, the city with 1 million of population and over is only a phenomenon of the 20th century or the modern world. Perhaps during that time, the population was not exceeding 100,000 people.
Genghis Khan is Mongolia's national hero. Since the end of Communist Party rule in 1990, Mongolian scholars have once again been free to give Genghis Khan the credit they feel is long overdue.
Historians in Mongolia and the majority of historians in the Western world credit Genghis Khan with four major achievements. First of all, he was a creator of the Mongolian nation and statehood. Second, he was the greatest military commander that the world has ever seen. He, through the conquest, established a completely new warfighting culture and ethos that was unparalleled in human history. Thirdly, he is accredited as a national hero of Mongolia. Finally, he is glorified as the founder of modern globalization. During his reign, the East and the West, the Occident and the Orient, were linked by myriad of political, economic, and cultural ties. Our two colossal neighbors, Russia and China, became what they are, truly global and regional powers, only as a result of the conquest of Mongol Empire.
In fact, from the start, there were also positive legends about the Mongols. At the end of the 14th century, Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales describes Genghis Khan as so excellent a lord in all things. By this time, the Mongols had withdrawn from most of Europe, almost as suddenly as they had come.
Their forays into Europe were really more exploratory, looking to see if Europe was worth conquering. And after studying the situation, assessing the cities and the value of Europe, they decided that compared to China, compared to India, compared to Persia, compared to Baghdad, that Europe really had very little to offer. So in the end, after these forays into Europe, they abandoned it.
But Europe's curiosity had been aroused. Like the Mongols, Europeans had for the first time begun to move beyond the borders of their continent. Crusading Christian knights ventured beyond the Mediterranean and the Bosporus into the Middle East, to the Holy Lands held by the Muslims. When a third, unknown party, the Mongols, entered the scene, Europeans could not help but see them from within their own Christian perspective.
In the 1230s, if I'm not mistaken, the Crusaders were stranded in Damiet in Egypt, and they had great problems in making progress. And there came these ideas, there is a king in the East, that must be the famous King David, who will come to the rescue of the Christians. Because by that time, late 1230s, news of Genghis Khan's conquest of Khwarezmian had come, part of what is now the Persian Empire, or what is now Iran. And news of this conquest had come, and he had defeated this Muslim king, so therefore he must be in sympathy with Christian cause.
The Europeans reacted to the invasion of Europe by the Mongols with mystification, puzzlement. We really could not understand who these people were and where they appeared. Why were they there? And it had caused a couple of very interesting expeditions to be launched. One of the first people to recognize the importance of these foreigners was the Pope, and the Pope organized the first envoy to the Mongols. Later, the King of France did the same. But Europeans also recognized that together with the horror that they felt at these unknown people, that maybe there was some chance there that the two could unite against a common enemy, against the Muslims.
The Mongols had totally different political ideas. For them, they could not have cared less, or they would never, never on any occasion have fought a war for religious reasons. They would just simply not see a point. And when the first letters of the Pope reached the Mongol Great Khans, the Mongol Great Khans immediately considered this as an offer to accept the sovereignty of the Mongols.
With plenty of room for misunderstanding, Europeans nevertheless hoped to Christianize the Mongols. Royal and papal envoys were sent to the Mongol courts. And for the first time, Latin Europe came into direct and conscious contact with the Asian Orient.
Pope Innocent sent out a very experienced diplomat, John of Plano Carpini, a man of some 60 years at the time, to go to Mongolia and find out as much as he could from the Mongols' way of life. Could they be won as allies? Could they even be won for Christianity? Would they accept baptism and all that sort of thing? Carpini has left us a detailed report on what he found among the Mongols, an absolutely fascinating, objective report, almost of ethnological quality, which even to this very day is of first-rate importance to scholars.
It's one of the funny scenes in Mongolian history when you have this envoy from the Pope coming as a very wonderful Franciscan friar by the name of Carpini. And he was rather heavy set and a little bit older. And he arrived there to introduce these people to Christianity. And what he found out is that there were many tribes in Central Asia who had been Christian before many of the Europeans had been Christian. And in fact, Genghis Khan married every one of his sons to a Christian woman. So some of the great queens, such as the mother of Kublai Khan, was a Christian woman. And so Carpini was completely perplexed at how these people could have so many Christians among them.
The Christianity practiced by some Mongols was Nestorianism, an ancient form of Eastern Christianity dating from the 5th century. But the first generations of Mongols did not grant any religion a privileged position, and they practiced a policy of strict religious tolerance.
This is indeed an entirely spiritual, not even decision, but a spiritual attitude the Mongols have towards religion. You know, there is no need to be aggressive. In the animist concept of the world, everything is inhabited by spirits, benevolent, malevolent. And there is no room for dispute over that. Different religions have their different spiritual world, and these worlds can be reconciled.
Because as one of the great Khans explained to the European envoy, Rubric, he said, "The religions of humans are like the fingers of God. Which would you have us disrespect?" And for the Mongols, it was a very powerful and important belief. That is, that all people have a religion, and all the religions are like the fingers of God. Everyone must be respected. But even a great queen such as Soraktani, who was a Christian and the mother of Kublai Khan, she founded madrasas for the study of Islam in the Middle East. She paid to have Buddhist texts transcribed and to have them printed. So she herself, even though she was a Christian, she sponsored works in all the religions that she encountered because she felt that each one had something to teach.
Well, this for the Mongols is not a value in its own right, a value in itself, but it is a question of political necessity, not to say of political opportunism. You win the elite of a country if you respect their religion. Interestingly enough, part of Genghis Khan's legislation, not only his own but also his successors, was that monasteries and religious organizations were exempt from tax.
Under the Mongols, one ruler controlled nearly the entire length of the Eurasian continent, and this made it possible for people and services to travel huge distances freely. Merchants like Marco Polo were able to journey safely for thousands of miles from Italy to the Far East. This Pax Mongolica, as it was called, led to the most advanced system of communication known to man up to that time. Under Mongol control, the steppes had become open thoroughfares for a global exchange of people, ideas, and goods.
Once the Mongols invaded Europe for the first time, they created a permanent contact that has not been broken till this day. Not only did first soldiers and prisoners of war move back and forth, but then envoys began to move, trade goods began to move. And so even from the very first invasion into Europe, the Mongols took back with them several thousand Saxons, for example, to become miners. They took back a whole group of people from Ossetia and Kipchak people from the south of Russia in order to become soldiers, and they later became the Imperial Guard for Kublai Khan. But created a connection, a diplomatic connection, a military connection, but that very quickly grew into a commercial connection and also an intellectual and cultural exchange of a greater magnitude than probably any other set of events in world history, except possibly the voyages of Columbus.
The Mongols, like no other people before, realized the importance of interpreters. In their chancery, the Mongols had an interpreter section where they had peoples who wrote and spoke various Turkish languages, Persian, Arabic, and Russian. And they had people who also had Latin and Greek. It was unbelievable. Without these interpreters in the service of the Mongol Khan, the letters of the Pope to the Mongol Khan and the letters of the Mongol Khan to the Pope would have failed their aim because they could not have understood each other.
The Mongolians were not craftsmen. They did not invent new things, but they moved it around. And suddenly after the Mongols arrived, and in Europe, you began to get things such as the printing press, gunpowder, the compass. These are the items that created the Renaissance in Europe. They all came from the Far East, and they all came as a result of the Mongol trade system, so that we began to develop a universal civilization. So at the same time that they were taking information about printing and compass and the abacus and gunpowder towards Europe, then they were bringing information about the making of glass and the making of steel out of the West and towards the East. So there was this global awakening of each civilization to the others. The Mongols connected them.
The commodities of the Silk Road just flowed into the Russian markets, and also ideas on political power and ideas on the state and state institutions, also from China, that penetrated Russian forests and steppes in the Middle Ages due to the Mongols.
No country in Europe was more affected by the Mongol conquests than Russia. Dr. Irina Morozova is a specialist in Mongolian history at the International Institute of Asian Studies at Amsterdam and Leiden Universities.
The infrastructure and the maintenance of transport communication was promoted by the Mongols in Russia, and also due to the overwhelming power of the Khan, the Russian princes were not so often in war against each other because their relationships were regulated from Sarai, the capital of Golden Horde. And this also, in certain way, united the Russian princes when they had to fight against the weakening Mongols later.
Their encounter with the Mongols has left Russians in a lasting state of ambivalence about whether they belong to Asia or Europe. At times, Russians embrace their Tatar identity. At other times, Russia likes to see itself as a guardian of civilization against the Asian hordes and as the self-sacrificing bearer of what is called the Mongol yoke.
And still, I believe in the textbooks of primary schools, you would still read about the Mongol yoke and its heavy suppression of the Russian state and of the fight of the Russian princes for independence, and still the idea that the Russians acted as a shield for Western Europe against the Mongols, it is still there, and it is occupying, I think, the minds of people.
It was thanks to the Mongols, however, that Moscow became a new center of power, and Mongol institutions like the Yasa legal system have had a lasting impact on Russia.
The Mongols were actually the founders of the Russian state, of the Moskova Khanate, as some scholars already call it. And just after the Golden Horde disintegrated, the Moskva princes just took after the Mongols. Nothing practically changed. They just utilized this legacy of superlegality, of political power that was beyond and above any, let's say, legal norms, like, for instance, in Western Europe, or above any kind of ritual or tradition, as, for instance, in Asia. And this is how the Russian autocracy was born. It was born in the Mongol Empire.
The Mongols lost control of their empire by the end of the 14th century. A new scourge, the Black Death, isolated and decimated the once interlinked communities of the Mongol Silk Road.
You know, I think every civilization has within it, within its greatest asset, is probably its greatest weakness. With the Mongols, the great emphasis on their civilization was on communication, the movement of people, goods, and ideas. And so the Mongols inadvertently also opened up the avenues so that the bubonic plague, the Black Death, could sweep across from China throughout the rest of Asia, Europe, and Africa. And it helped to bring about very quickly the end of the Mongol Empire.
Subsequent centuries largely forgot the Mongol contribution to civilization. Mongols became associated with barbarism and even mental retardation in children. But our own global age has opened the possibility of a new perspective.
Absolutely. The Mongol Empire, for the short period that it was in existence as an empire, it was incredible to what extent ideas, as well as technologies, material goods, and so on, travel. For example, it is only fairly recently that scholars have discovered the impact of Mongol administration in Persia, of Mongol administration in China, of Mongol administration, in fact, in all the conquered areas. And it is fascinating that certain chancery practices in Persia are now modeled, still now, modeled on Mongol ideas.
And also we can see the empire that they tried to create was a multi-ethnic empire where everyone had a role, which allowed for all religions, which was based upon the movement of goods rather than the storing and the protection of goods, which was based upon communication, which was based upon everyday practical life and not upon revelation from God for how we should run our lives. I think the time is right now for a reassessment of Genghis Khan and the Mongols and the role of history, because we've had enough time to pass where we can see it more clearly.
You've been listening to Cavalry, Caravans, and Christians, Genghis Khan and Europe's First Global Age. The program was produced and presented by Marijke van der Meer. This has been a Radio Netherlands Worldwide production.